Throughout the ages, history has been altered by word of mouth and the misrepresentation of those who might not have been present when some of the world's most significant events took place. Channelers Barry and Connie Strom bring through the spirits of those who actually witnessed or took part in these historical events and lets them tell their stories in their own words. Welcome to Channeling History. And now, here are your hosts, Barry and Connie Strom.
Good evening, everybody. I'd like to thank everyone for sticking with us. It's been kind of a rough couple weeks with COVID, but we're back. Probably going to hear some coughing, but we're going to do the best we can do. We're brought to you every week on the Parrax Radio Network. Connie and I hope that we're going to be able to get through her tonight, but I'm going to do the best we can. I'm Barry Strom, your host, and I'll be doing the channeling.
And I'm Connie Strom, your co-host. Tonight, we're going to be channeling three famous outlaws of the Old West, Jesse James, Butch Cassidy, and Billy the Kid. I think you'll enjoy the stories of these three famous gunslingers. I'll be asking the questions, as usual, of our guests tonight. All of our shows are available on our YouTube channel in the name of Barry Strom. We currently have around 520 videos on our channel that encompass all aspects of the paranormal and afterlife. If you'd like to download the videos, just go to Podomatic.com and search Channeling History. So please tell your friends about us so we can continue to grow our audience.
Tonight we're going to be interviewing the spirits of some very interesting individuals. So we are going to do a disclaimer. The opinions or statements voiced on our show or the channeled words of the spirits do not necessarily reflect our opinions, those of the Parrax Network, or of our sponsors. Now, before we channel, we always say a prayer of protection. So Connie's going to say the prayer, and we'll begin to channel with our guests tonight.
God, please grant us your wisdom and protection. Grant us the knowledge that we can handle and keep us safe from all things that will harm us. Keep the messages positive and pure love. Keep us safe from our egos. We ask these things in the light of the seen, the unseen, and the honesty of God. Amen.
All right, Connie, we got some really great guests tonight. So let's begin with Jesse James. Jesse was born in 1847, died in 1882 at the age of 34 from a gunshot in the back of the head by Robert Ford. He was a friend and member of his gang. Jesse was a strong advocate of the Confederacy during the Civil War. He fought in groups led by William Quantrell, Bloody Bill Anderson. He remains one of the most famous of our American outlaws. He was true to his cause. He did a lot of things that weren't exactly correct, but it was a very difficult time. So, Connie, let's begin with our guest, Jesse James.
Welcome, Jesse. Nice to have you here this evening. You lived in Missouri, a border state, prior to the Civil War. How did the concept of slavery affect the state of Missouri leading up to the Civil War?
Well, in those days, the argument was who was going to get slavery and who wasn't. The Union didn't want to pass slavery on to the other states, the expansion states, Kansas, Missouri. But there were many of us that owned slaves and wanted to pass it on unto the new areas. Okay. The government continued to argue. They didn't know what they wanted to do. It was a terrible time. Senators were actually getting into fist fights over it. Slavery was tearing the country apart. Those of us that grew up in the South had slaves. We never really understood just how terrible it was because it was a way of life. We relied on it. Slavery was what generated the labor we needed for pick the cotton, to do many of the other things in the South. Keep in mind, there was no real source of cheap labor in those days. So slavery just seemed like the normal way of life to us.
Yeah, you lived in Clay County, Missouri, where slaves accounted for about 25% of the populations and where they only accounted for 10% in the rest of the state. Why was slavery so prevalent in Clay County?
Clay County was a higher income area in the state of Missouri. Many of the people in Missouri came to Clay County to live. They brought their slaves with them. They had plantations. Clay County wasn't too much different than many of the other counties in the South, in Mississippi or Alabama or the Carolinas. As I said, it was a way of life. I know as you look back, it's hard to believe that 25% of the population would be slaves and not free people. But that was the way it was. We followed the way of life that we'd grown up with. We thought that it was our right. We thought that we would protect the right that we had. And we decided we'd go to war over.
In 1854, Congress passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act. How did that affect life in Missouri?
Well, we wanted slavery to go into Kansas and Nebraska. The Northerners were hell-bent that it wasn't going to go in there. So there were a lot of people who were willing to take up guns and fight over it. The Kansas-Nebraska Act was simply something that the politicians came up with. There was really no basis for it. All we knew was that we wanted slavery to progress westward, and all those in the North knew is they didn't want it to do that. So there was only one way we were going to discuss who won. Sadly, the Confederacy lost, but we still continued to fight. And I know we shouldn't have done it, but we made an awful lot of enemies during the Civil War. We were guerrilla fighters, and we fought differently. We would attack army posts, and we would do things we shouldn't have done, just the same as the Union would do things to us they shouldn't have done. So hatred brings on hatred, and anger brings on anger. And even though the people in Washington thought the war had ended, some of us kind of had a different consideration of it.
I can see that. In the East, we're familiar with large battles taking place between armies. How did the fighting take place in Missouri?
There were a couple small battles took place. We didn't have large armies here in Missouri like you had back East. Keep in mind that Washington was the capital of the North, but it was also right in the middle of the South. So it took large armies to try to protect the cities. We didn't have the real large cities out in Missouri at the time, but we did have people that were willing to fight for what they believed in. As I said, we formed a lot of guerrilla troops. That's underground, fought from behind. A lot of us still takes place today in your battles. They just call them partisans. We would form into groups. We'd have our officers. Generally, we were cavalry mounted, and we would plan raids. If the Union had a facility where they kept their ammunition on the rail, we would try to raid it and steal their ammunition and kill the Yankees. It was a very, very difficult and an incredibly violent time.
Were there any rules of war between the two sides?
Not really. Sometimes you'd have family members fighting on the other side and you'd give them a favor. But generally, it was some of the most violent encounters that you could ever consider. It was a very difficult time, and it was very violent.
Okay. What was it like fighting under command of William Quantrill?
Quantrill was a tough man. He had many of his friends who were killed by the Yankees. He was a great fighter, good horseman, knew what he was doing. He was good at planning raids. When you rode with Quantrill, you rode with one of the best. If you look back at history, you'll see that he doesn't have a great reputation. But as a military man, he succeeded in quite a few of the things that he tried to do. It was just a simply different time. Quantrill, Bill Anderson, they did what they thought they had to do. Yes, I know they didn't have to be as violent, but in those days, if you didn't kill, you were going to probably get killed. So it's just the way it was.
Yeah. Tell us about Quantrill's raid on Lawrence, Kansas. And did you participate in that raid?
Yes, I did participate in the raid on Lawrence. Quantrill wanted to run up a body count. He decided that Lawrence, Kansas would be a good place to raid. There were a lot of Union sympathizers there. So he led the boys, and we raided the town, and we killed a lot of the Yankees there. We probably didn't have to be quite as violent as we were, but we were trying to send them a lesson.
Will you tell us about the Centralia Massacre and the ambush of Major A.E. Johnson's Union troops? Did you kill Major Johnson?
The Union used the railroads to move their troops around. Johnson had a bunch of troops. We raided the railroad at Centralia and killed a bunch of the Union boys. The major himself tried to come to the rescue, but we ambushed him as well. And I would admit that I did play a role in the killing of him.
When the Civil War ended, why did the fighting not stop?
Well, we figured the wrong side won. We'd made a lot of enemies, and we just simply weren't going to quite give up yet. There was a lot of wealth in the Union. They had a lot of money. They were transporting it on their trains. The military had a bunch of money. It was a very difficult time. We weren't about to give up. Just because the cowards back east decided to stop fighting didn't mean that we had to stop.
Sometimes you were referred to as a type of Robin Hood. Did you ever attempt to split what you stole with the poor?
No. We had enough trouble trying to support ourselves on what we could take. We would try to be very kind towards Southern sympathizers. Whenever we would do one of our raids, we would try to know who was on our side and who wasn't. And if the people were from Confederate families, we would generally spare them and not steal from them. So I guess in that one respect, you might call us a type of Robin Hood. But there was really very little good about us.
Jesse, how did you personally respond to the end of the Civil War?
I hated it. I felt that there was no way that it should be over. I thought that we still should go on. Whenever you're fighting in secret bodies like we were, it's like you're isolated. Yes, they're trying to kill you, and you're trying to kill them, but it's not like you're part of these large armies that are moving back and forth. When you're raised in the techniques of guerrilla warfare, it just seems like your families will protect you. It seems like nothing is going to happen, so you think that it's safe. We wanted to continue to steal from the Yankees. As I said before, they had great wealth, and we felt that they had taken advantage of us during the war, and we just continued to take advantage of them.
Why did you ever think that you could successfully rob a bank in Minnesota?
Well, we had studied it. We thought that it was the last place they were expecting us. We had never raided a bank in Minnesota before, and we thought we could catch them off guard. Sadly, things didn't go the way we wanted it to, and we almost lost our entire gang up there. Stupid mistake. We should have never done it. We should have stayed down in the area that we knew. We should have stayed where we knew we had friends. But I guess it was just the way of things that if you're going to be breaking the laws, that it'll catch up with you.
How did that failure affect your work?
Well, we lost most of our boys up there. There were still my brother and I, but we tried to reorganize. But the real experienced individuals that we counted on were gone. And it was just definitely the end of our operation. After Minnesota, we brought people into the group that we couldn't trust, and I paid for it with my life.
Yeah, did you think that Robert Howard was going to kill you?
I didn't kind of trust him, but I didn't think he had the balls to do it. I turned my back on him, and that was a major mistake. He was a snake, and I guess I kind of tempted him and found out that he had a little bit more to him than I thought he did.
Yeah, why did you turn your back on him? Why did you trust him that much?
I figured that I had to test him. In those days, you had to test who was really your friends, and you had to test who wasn't. I just kind of found out the hard way that he really wasn't one of my friends.
How were you judged when you returned to heaven?
Well, they weren't real happy with some of the things that I did. We had lived a very violent life. There were many people that we took lives that we really wouldn't have had to take. We were violent in places we shouldn't have had to be violent. So they weren't real happy when I returned. They pointed out that during war there is a bit of an excuse, but once the war is over, you're just nothing more than an outlaw, and you're stealing from those people, and you're just trying to hurt them. And the violence that you do has really no excuse of protection. So they weren't real happy with me when I returned. I must admit that. I'm going to have quite a bit of karma to pay for in the future. And they did put me back. I did lose a layer in heaven, which I truly regret. People are responsible for their free will. They have to learn to make their decisions. And trust me, when you make bad decisions, you're going to find out about what you did wrong when you get back home. I would warn everyone that's listening that violence, taking lives, stealing, doing a lot of the things that we did, very bad. It's probably the last thing you could think about. And the guides are watching. There's no question about that. When you get home, you will find out the hard way.
Jesse, thank you for sharing your story with us this evening. Do you have any further final messages for us?
Yes, I would like to thank you for allowing me to come through. You're living in very violent times, the same as I lived in violent times. If people don't follow the words of God, do good things, then they're going to pay for it. That's the way things work. You may think that you won't pay for it when you're living your life, but when the time comes that you close those eyes for the final time, you're going to realize there are people on the other side that were watching, and they're keeping score. It's a lot easier to live a good life, actually. There's a lot of things that were on my conscience that I did. I'd wished I hadn't done a bunch of things, but I did. And that's the way it was. We lived in very violent times, and I paid the price for it. So thank you for allowing me to come through.
Thank you. Okay, our next guest is Butch Cassidy. He was born in 1866 and supposedly died in 1908. His proper name was Robert Leroy Parker. His claim to fame was being a member of the Wild Bunch in the Old West, made famous by the movie Butch Cassidy and a Sundance Kid. His family arrived in 1856 as Mormon pioneers, and he was the first of 13 children born to his immigrant parents. thank you so much for joining us again, Butch. Why did you leave home as a teenager?
Well, when you're a member of a Mormon family, when you're living in a little cabin, has maybe three rooms in it, and your family's trying to have as many children as possible, you kind of run out of space. I tried my best to help around on the farm for a bit, but didn't take long to realize that that wasn't what I wanted to really do.
Tell us about the cattle thief, Mike Cassidy.
Well, when I left home, wasn't too sure what I was going to do. It wasn't exactly like I had any education. I had been working on the family farm, taking care of the animals, doing things. Couldn't figure out much what I wanted to do, but I was introduced to Mike. Mike was, I guess, no other way to describe him but a cattle thief. In those days, a lot of people stole. It wasn't like there were these big companies that were hiring people with jobs. You had to make a living. A lot of the cattle barons had a lot of wealth. They had these animals. And it was a big, wide open country. It wasn't a time of fences. You would brand your cattle, your sheep, or whatever. But basically, they would be allowed to run wild. And they were kind of like just there for the taking if you wanted to take them. Now, of course, the downside was if you got caught, because the guy that owned those cattle looked down very roughly on anyone trying to steal them from him. But many people made a living stealing cattle. It's what they did. There were huge cattle drives taking place. It was just simply, it was a way of life that many of you can't imagine. So, but Mike was a good guy. He taught me a lot. Perhaps he taught me some things I shouldn't have known, but he taught me how to get along. I was very, very young when I met him, took me under his wing, and I thank him for it.
So how did you get the name Butch?
Well, as I said, I was trying to find a way to make a living. So I was near Rock Springs in Wyoming, and I took a job as a butcher. I thought, well, maybe if I learned to cut meat up, it would be a way to get along in life. But I found out right away that there wasn't a whole lot of money in that, and there was a hell of a lot more money in stealing cattle.
Will you tell us about the Wild Bunch?
In those days, Utah was very wild country. The Mormons had settled it basically in the Salt Lake area, but there were a lot of very, very rural areas. Now, if you had been in Utah, you know that there's a lot of canyons, a lot of dead-end draws, a lot of places that you can hide. So I wasn't the only one that was stealing cattle at the time. There were many others, and I started to make some friends in the business. And we decided, well, maybe we ought to put together this little group called the Wild Bunch. We weren't afraid to drink a little alcohol or party on weekends or do what we had to do. And we decided that if we got together in this group, that we could do bigger jobs, maybe rob a railroad or two here and there, or rob a mine. You see, in those days, they were doing a lot of silver mining, and they would transport the mine payrolls, so there was an awful lot of opportunity to steal, and there was a lot of opportunity to hide, and we thought that by creating this group of guys that we called the Wild Bunch, we'd be able to make a little bit of money.
So why did you ever pose for the picture, the Fort Worth Five?
We ask ourselves that question many times. My friends, it was a bunch of the five of us, we were drinking, and that was a bad start. The guy said, wouldn't it be really good if we could see ourselves in this picture together? Well, nobody understood that picture was going to become a wanted poster. Up until that time, nobody knew what we looked like. So It's amazing how a little bit of alcohol can certainly get you screwed up.
It still does the same. Will you tell us about Harry Alonzo Longabaugh? He's the Sundance Kid.
Harry became a really good friend of mine. We became very close, and we decided that we would try to stick together, that we would maybe steal a little bit of money here and there, that we would do what we needed to do to accumulate some wealth. It was also a time that Law and Order thought that they were going to take over. The Pinkertons were a detective agency, and the railroads would hire the Pinkertons to come after us. And it was starting to get a little bit more dangerous than it had been in the past. But Harry was a good guy. He was a very good friend of mine. We stuck together. We did many things.
Butch, did you ever personally kill somebody?
I can honestly say that I never killed anyone personally. Now, I may have shot at a few people, but I cannot tell you that I'm aware that I personally killed anyone.
In 1901, you fled to South America. Why did you leave the country at that point?
The Pinkertons were on our tail. They were slowly catching our gang members. They were slowly destroying the world that we lived in. Law and order was coming. We realized that it was just going to be a matter of time until we were either killed or captured. Harry and I thought that it would be great to go down to South America. There were huge cattle ranches down there. It was a place that we could start over. And we felt it was a place that the Pinkertons wouldn't follow us. After all, it was halfway around the world. So we got on a steamer, and Harry and I and his girlfriend, we went on down there to South America. We had stolen quite a bit of money, and we had quite a bit of wealth. So we bought this large ranch, and we tried to raise cattle down in Argentina.
So when you were in Argentina, did you obey the laws?
For a while. It was very difficult. It just seemed like those laws were something that needed to be broken. So we did. We traveled down further south in the country, and we did do some a little bit of stealing that we shouldn't have done. And then once we did that, we started to realize that that was really pretty stupid because we were relatively safe. We'd heard rumors that the Pinkertons were coming after us, but we had been warned about them, but we didn't really see any great risk at the time.
Did they ever find you in South America?
The Pinkertons never found us, no.
Okay. Did you and Harry rob the Aramayo mine in southern Bolivia?
Well, maybe. Harry and I decided that we ought to do a little something to fake our death. That we were down here in the middle of nowhere in Bolivia. That we still had some money. We had sold our cattle. We had sold our properties. And we thought that if we worked with the Bolivian army, that we might just be able to set up a situation where people thought we were killed. We went to the mine and took one of the mules. Now, that was pretty stupid because it had the mark of the mine on it. So everyone in the area realized that mule had a home. So a couple of boys in the army down there, they weren't paid anything. So we went to them and we made up this situation, shall we say, where it would look like Sundance and I had robbed a local mine and had paid the price with our lives. Well, went pretty good. Everybody thought we'd died, put some fake graves down, paid everybody off. Everyone seemed cool, real happy about it. And Sundance and I got back on a freighter and headed back north.
Were there any dead bodies found in St. Vincent?
Not really. People said they saw dead bodies, but if you pay them enough money, generally they'll say pretty much whatever you want them to say. But we did a pretty good job of faking our death.
Did you return and visit your family in Utah?
Absolutely. Once people thought we were dead, we certainly weren't going to stay in that hellhole Bolivia. We came back north, and I worked at several different jobs. My family was very large, and it was in Utah. And I actually became a pretty successful businessman. As I said, we still had some money left over after we had arranged for people thinking that we'd been killed. I did several different things. I worked in had some mines in Nevada. Had a couple jobs up in Washington State. Assumed some different names that nobody would ever recognize. And we would go back and visit with my family in Utah. Keep in mind, in those days, it wasn't real populated down where they lived. They had a fairly good-sized property. And there were some rural areas on the property where we used to camp. And actually, we spent quite a bit of time with my family in Utah after we came back.
So how and where did you finally die?
Well, I did. I was actually in Nevada when I died, but I had been very careful. We had traveled. I had had some facial surgery done so people didn't recognize me. Now my family did. My sister and brothers still realized who I was. But I had left home at such an early time that nobody really understood who I was back there. I did a lot of things right. I really stayed away from crime once I got back. I had that nest egg. Harry had a nest egg as well. And we simply tried to go straight and live normal lives. It's a lot easier when you have a little bit of money, but we did really what we wanted to do. Now, I know the Pinkertons doubted that we had pulled this off, and one worry that we did have is that they would show up sometime on our doorstep unexpected. But we did a pretty good job of covering our tracks. It was an interesting life after we got back up. Actually, I lived long enough to drive a Ford.
Oh, my.
Came down, picked my sister up in it. She was impressed. But things were much different then. It was possible that you could change your appearance, you could change your life, you could change your lifestyle. Many people can't do that. But Harry and I think that we really succeeded. I would say that we did a fairly good job.
Yeah. How did you finally die? Was it natural causes?
I was in Nevada, and I got sick. I think it was probably what you refer to as pneumonia, but I simply just died a natural death, and that was the way it was.
And how were you judged when you returned to heaven?
Now, I must say they slapped my fingers a bit when I got back. I always tried to be careful not to kill anyone. Now, I did steal. Stole a lot of money in my time. Did a lot of things. Deceived a lot of people. And the guides were real quick to point all this out. But they did cut me a little slack because I hadn't been as violent as a lot of the other people in those days. I tried to change my life. Can't say that I really tried to help too many other people. But I wasn't judged as harshly as I guess I could have been. I have karmas that I'll have to pay back when I decide to return. But I can't say that I didn't get anything I didn't deserve.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Do you have a final message for our listeners?
Yes, thank you so much. I always enjoy coming through. I guess I'm just kind of proud that I beat the system. The whole world thought we had died down there. We did a pretty good job. It's amazing when you got a little bit of money and you can make a plan that works. Harry and I pulled it off. We had a lot of luck with us. We were able to change our appearances a bit. And we were able to find places in the country where nobody had any idea who we were. So, well, I guess when you look back at me, you think of me as an outlaw, and I was. I stole, did a lot of things I shouldn't have done. A lot of carousing. A little too much drinking, but that's the way it is. But I thank you for allowing me to come through again. I know that I don't deserve people to pay attention to me, but it's not all bad. Thank you.
I disagree with you. I think it's good to know true history, how things really happened. So thank you again. Henry McCarty, better known as Billy the Kid, was born in New York City in 1859 and is said to have been killed by U.S. Marshal Pat Garrett in 1881. He became involved in the Lincoln County Wars and worked as a rustler, ranch hand, horse thief, and outlaw. So, welcome back, Billy. You were 14 years old when your mother died, and your father abandoned you. What was it like being on your own in the 1870s?
Well, wasn't too damn easy, I can tell you that. When you're 14, really not much you can do. I tried to get work, but I wasn't experienced. I tried to do a lot of things, but I found out about the only choice I had was to try to steal. If I didn't steal, I wasn't going to be able to exist. So, you learn to steal. I was basically abandoned out in this wild western country. Everybody packed a gun. Everybody was trying to get the best of you. If somebody thought they could take advantage of you, they would do it. They would not hesitate. It was a very, very difficult time. There was very little what you would call law and order. Everybody seemed to be at everyone else's throats. Everybody wanted what anyone else had. It was a time where you either had to sink or swim. You had to do what you had to do. If you were sitting in a bar having a drink, and this guy comes in and tries to make fun of you, you got to protect yourself. You got to do what you have to do. And I did what I had to do.
Was there such a thing as an honest lawman in the Old West?
Not really. If you look at all the lawmen that were out there, they all had a past. I mean, even the ones that you look up to, like Wyatt Earp, he ran a brothel. Everybody out there seemed to just be trying to get along and do the best they could do. If they thought that they could get away with something, they would do it. Many of the lawmen of the time were just simply working for wealthy people. Sheriff Brady, for instance, he was working for, he was on the take. There's no question about it. He went out and killed my friend because he simply thought he could get away with it. Basically, the lawmen were on one side or the other. It wasn't till years later that things started to stabilize a bit. But, no, I'm not sure there was such a thing as an honest lawman in those days.
Did you kill Sheriff Brady?
Maybe. I'd watched him shoot down my good friend. And I told myself when I had a chance at him, I was going to take it.
Will you tell us about killing Bob Olinger and leaving Lincoln, New Mexico?
Well, I got involved in the Lincoln County Wars. It seems like everybody else could get a pardon during the war except me. The lawmen stabbed me in the back. They told me that if I would testify before grand juries, that they would give me a pardon. I did it. They didn't give me a pardon. Everybody else would apply for a pardon and get it, and I'd be convicted. I will admit that I did have a hand in killing Brady. He had killed my friend, and I just thought that was the only way he was ever going to get justice. So when you pull the trigger and you can see him laying there on the ground, you realize that justice has been served. I think that really got to them, though, because killing Brady was the thing that always seemed to keep me from getting a pardon. I was finally arrested and convicted of killing Brady. They took me to Lincoln, New Mexico. Now, Olinger, I got several bad names I could call him, but I'm not going to do it. But he decided he was going to try to make fun of me. Now, he was in charge. I was in handcuffs, and he was in charge of moving me to Lincoln because they had these plans that they were going to kill me there. They were going to hang me. Didn't kind of agree with those plans like Olinger did. So one day, we're in Lincoln. I tell my guard I got to go to the bathroom. Now, I had a double-jointed thumb, so I knew that when I wanted to get out of the handcuffs, I could do it. So I got him to take me down to the shitter, and coming back, I slipped the cuffs on him and started to hit him, grabbed his gun out of his holster. He was a good guy. I didn't want to hurt him. I said, stop, don't run, don't do anything. But he took off, and I was forced to shoot him. Well, after I shot him, I went up into the room where they were keeping me. I saw that Olinger forgot to take his shotgun along when he took some guys over to the hotel for lunch. So he's heard the gunshot, comes running across in the middle of the street, and I let him get pretty close, and I said, the window was open. And I said, oh, Bob, I got something for you. And I put both barrels into him. And that was the last time he ever picked on me. So I got a horse. Now, they had me in leg irons. Took me a little bit of time with an axe to get out from under that. But just simply rode out of town. Nobody wanted to stop me, so I thought, well, I'd just say goodbye to him.
Would you please tell us about the night that you were supposedly killed by Pat Garrett?
Yes. We were at a ranch in Fort Sumter, New Mexico. I was with my friend Billy, and we had heard that Garrett had a small posse and that they could possibly be chasing after us. Now, we didn't really know where he was, but I was a bit fond of the daughter of the rancher where we were. Now, we didn't realize it, but Garrett's on the same ranch. But my friend decided that he was hungry, and the rancher had killed a cow, and he wanted to go over and get some beef. And I warned him. I said, don't do it. I said, it's dangerous because we don't know where Garrett is right now. So Billy goes over, and Garrett shoots him in the back thinking it's me. Now, Garrett knows he's made a mistake, and he knows that you can't just go shooting people in the back. So he gets a bunch of his cronies, forms a grand jury, declares that my buddy's body is my body, and buries him. Well, when I heard him shoot my friend, I came running over to see what was happening, and they started shooting at me. Well, I started shooting back. I did get hit with a couple rounds, but I managed to get on my horse and get out of town. So I was wounded, had about 3 new holes in my body, but I went on down to Mexico and got out of there. I figured it was no place to be with Garrett. Having just killed the wrong person, I was wondering how he was going to explain things. So I went down, and I started to heal up and decided, well, Garrett had made a pretty good story that he killed me. So why don't I just go along with it? I could see no reason that I would jump out publicly and just say, oh, no, I'm not dead. So why don't you shoot me again? So I decided to get out of New Mexico. And I did a bunch of different things. Even spent a little time with the Wild West show. Cody never recognized who I was, of course. But I decided that I would just try to start a new life. I didn't want to lose the advantage of everybody thinking I was dead. So I stopped killing people, tried to get work, wound up in Texas, and just simply tried to live out my life.
Okay, one of our listeners would like to know, Billy, do you still see the regulators on the other side?
Yeah, they're a bunch of good boys. Still love to ride with them, talk. We still hang out over here. In many instances, things don't change a whole lot here in heaven. It's when you got good friends, you just kind of try to stick with them, even though you're on this side.
Okay. There was a $500 reward on your head. Why would the governor not pay that reward to Pat Garrett?
Because they suspected he was lying about killing me.
Okay.
Keep in mind that there were people there that understood that he had shot the wrong person. Garrett had threatened him. He had done a lot of things so that they would go along with the lie. But even the governor had doubts. It took him quite a few years to collect that money.
Where was the first place you went after you escaped from Fort Sumter?
I headed to get down to Mexico where it was safe. I didn't want to mess with the U.S. lawmen at that point. Okay.
Can you prove to our listeners that you survived the shooting by Pat Garrett?
Well, it ain't easy. I tried to live a normal life. I went to Texas and tried to do some things down there. But I was always very careful. When I was Billy, I was involved in a lot of shooting. When I decided that I was going to go public, that I was still alive, and the main reason for it was I wanted to still get the parole to which I was entitled. Even in those later days, the governor still screwed me on that, but that was the whole intent that was behind what I did. I actually took some great steps. I had an inspection done of my body. I had 26 different bullet holes and knife scars on my body. Many of them corresponded to the wounds that I'd received as Billy. I'd had some pretty tough lives, years there during the Lincoln County War. I'd been wounded many times, and Garrett got a couple bullets into me that night at the ranch. I showed the reporter the different wounds, and I even went so far as to meet with some of the guys that I had ridden with earlier. Four of the individuals that knew me earlier in life actually signed affidavits stating that I was actually Billy the Kid. They had known me in life, and they looked at a lot of the scars and agreed and actually signed papers that I was Billy the Kid. So many years had passed that it was very, very difficult for me to convince people. I had done a pretty good job of covering my tracks. I had not wanted people to understand that I was a famous outlaw. I figured that wouldn't end well. Can I prove it from over here? No. I can point out those things that I tried to do. The fact that I could convince four people that I had known in my youth that I was truly Billy, that they would actually sign papers to say that, I would think that would be pretty good proof. But once you're over here, you lose any way that you have of trying to step back in time and prove things.
So did you assume the life of Wishy Bill Roberts in Hillco, Texas?
Yes. It was the individual that had been Wishy Bill had a very complex past, and he had actually been killed, and there was no proof of his death. So I felt that it would be a safe identity to assume. As it turned out, the identity was so safe that I couldn't prove to anybody that I had actually assumed that identity.
Why did you finally decide to go public that you were Billy the Kid in that so late in life?
I wanted to prove I wanted to get my parole. I was entitled to it. They'd promised it to me. I'd done everything that they asked me to do. And then they stabbed me in the back and would not give me a parole. I felt that it was justice, and I still wanted it. And I thought that maybe time had changed, that people would be honest.
How were you judged when you finally passed into heaven?
There were some good things and mostly bad things. I had done, a lot of the things I had done were in self-defense. Some of them were justice, but the guides weren't real pleased with some of my actions. I was given quite a few karmas that I'll have to live when I return. That's why I've been putting it off, not rushing back. But there will be a time that I pay for what I did. You can always run, but you can't hide. I proved that to myself.
Billy, thank you so much for joining us again. Do you have a final message for our listeners?
Yes. I'd like everybody to understand that you might be able to run, but you can't hide from the way you live your life. I did a lot of things wrong. A lot of it was the times. A lot of it were things in which I was given no choice. But they do take notes over on the other side. And there will be a time that you will understand that you will pay for what you do. It's a lot easier to live a good life. I spent a lot of years hiding, a lot of years worrying. If you just simply go out and do what's right, then you do not have to put yourself through those ordeals. So thank you for allowing me to come back. Always enjoy talking with you guys. You're always real friendly. And when you get a chance to talk with humans, you better damn well take it. So thank you. Thank you for having me, and goodbye.
Thank you.
Okay. I got through it almost. A little coughing, but that's the way it is. Next week, we're going to be channeling the spirits of Harriet Tubman, Margaret Sanger, and Susan B. Anthony. These three women fought to change a world during times when men ruled the world. Tubman was very instrumental in bringing slaves up the Underground Railway. Sanger is going to be very interesting as a founder of women's health organizations. And Susan Anthony was a very strong fighter for women's rights. So tell your friends about it. I think you're going to enjoy it. My 10th book, Modern Messages of the Archangels, is available for purchase. The book can be purchased in paperback, hardcover, and ebook on Amazon. Signed copies are available on my website, barrystrom.com. During the past several years, I channeled 20 different archangels, and we bring you the messages in a single volume. We're very excited about this new release, and we hope you tell your friends about it.
And I'd like to thank you all for joining us this evening on Channeling History. I'm still trying to understand that we've been doing this show for 3 years. We've been trying to bring you the truth about history by speaking to the souls that lived the events. It's only by understanding the events of the past that we can prepare for the future. So hope you all have a wonderful week. God bless all of you.
All our shows are on our YouTube channel, so my name, Barry Strom. Thank you for listening. Please join us Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Pararex Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to Channeling History. Tune in again next week for another electrifying episode, as we never know who will make an appearance or who will come through the portal. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2020. Our story begins by Kevin MacLeod, licensed through Incompetech.com.